linguistic art chick.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. And I want to begin today's podcast with a huge thank you to Max K., Derek J., and Tor L., who made very generous donations to help offset the expenses of these podcasts. Max, Derek, and Tor, I really appreciate your help. Thanks a lot, you guys, and I hope you enjoy today's program, which I'm thinking of as Tim Leary with a Twist, which you'll understand better after we hear today's talk. Lately, I've been spot-checking various recordings from the Timothy Leary Archive, which were sent to me, by the way, from the Futique Trust, who provided these materials under the same Creative Commons license that I use here in the salon. And I also want to acknowledge the fact that it was actually through the good graces of our friend Bruce Damer that these recordings actually made their way to me. You've heard Bruce on several podcasts here, but what you should also know is that Bruce is the person most instrumental for me being able to use all of this wonderful Leary material, and he's also the person who secured the use of the Trialogue recordings from Ralph Abraham. I don't mention his name very often, but I do want you to know what an important role Bruce Damer continues to play here in our salon. Anyway, I've been trying to find some good examples of Dr. Leary's thinking about psychedelic substances and that have also have a good sound quality. Eventually, I plan on getting all of these recordings podcast, but for now, I want to first give you a sampling of the wide range of his thinking. So instead of one of his more esoteric talks, today I'm going to continue my little mini-history lesson about the cultural transformation that took place as the mind-numbing 50s were replaced by a less rigid frame of mind. Actually, the talk we're about to hear was recorded in late March of 1987 at a conference titled The 60s, Leaders and Legacies. And Dr. Leary's talk was titled, and it really isn't fully clear which was the official title, but it was either The Cyber Society or The Counterculture. And let me get one of my pet peeves out of the way here. I refuse to let those screwheads in our nation's capitals call us the counterculture. We are the culture, the human culture. They're the ones who are bucking the trends of humanity with their counterculture of fast food and conspicuous consumption. Sorry about that. But I just think it's about time we take back our sense of place in human society. Actually, I didn't mean to sound so angry just now. The truth is, I really get a kick out of laying that rap on my Republican friends. And it can be a real mind-opener for these conservatives to begin to see that they aren't really in the majority anymore. They really are the counterculture, and you can almost see their heads beginning to explode when the truth hits them. For most of them, such an aha moment can maybe be their first psychedelic experience, and on the natch at that. Now, how did I get so far off track? All I intended to say just now was that we're about to hear another talk that is more about the journey we've taken to get to this place in time than it is about lessons learned on a deep psychedelic journey. In a way, I think it's always good to pause once in a while and take a look back to see whether or not we've been traveling down the right road and if we're actually going forward. Now, please keep in mind that this talk was given over 20 years ago. You know, back in the day when Pac-Man and Centipede were the hot games. Back before the iPod. Back even before Tim Berners-Lee came up with his idea for the World Wide Web. You know, a lot has taken place since this talk was given. So now let's join the famous and infamous Abbie Hoffman as he introduces Dr. Timothy Leary for a Sunday morning talk on March 22, 1987, which makes it almost exactly 21 years ago that this talk was originally given. Oh, and I better warn you, there are a few places where Timothy gets really excited and pounds his fist on the podium. Not only is it a little disconcerting if you're listening to this on your headphones, but it also jiggled the microphone contact and adds some static to the pounding. It's really a nice effect once you get used to it. And I might as well also let you know right now that this tape came to quite a sudden and very unexpected end. And so far I haven't been able to locate the rest of it. And actually, you might even find some kind of a strange significance in the abrupt ending. Now, how's that for a teaser? Okay, I'll be quiet now. Let's join Abby Hoffman.
In the post-60s world of holistic medicine, at a time when we talk about self-help and ancient herbal remedies and spiritual healing and things like this, one of our local institutions that seems to typify the exact opposite of it is the Kaiser medical facilities that proliferate around here. Our next speaker, and this may be hard for you to believe, was a director of psychological research at the Kaiser Foundation Hospital in Oakland for something like 16 years. I'm talking, of course, about Timothy Leary, who went on from Kaiser to Harvard University, where he began experimenting with things like the sacred mushroom and LSD at the Center for Personality Research, and for which he was bounced from Harvard in 1963. Fortunately, he did not go back to Kaiser. Timothy Leary has written widely about his experiences. The best place to start, if you don't know much about it, I would recommend his autobiography, a book called Flashbacks, that was published a few years ago by Tarcher Books. It's a very good book. And I'm always struck when I look at that book at the enthusiasm, the passion that underlay the early research in mind-changing drugs. It's the same kind of enthusiasm and scientific adventure that you find when you read Watson's book, The Double Helix, about scientific research on DNA. There's a tremendous enthusiasm and belief in possibilities. Of course, the rest of the world didn't see things like that. And for his troubles in research and various experiments and outrageous behavior, Timothy Leary was bounced around this country in a lot of directions, including prison, from which he escaped at one point, went off to Europe, hit out with Eldridge Cleaver in Algeria for a while, and eventually returned to America and made good. He is today the president of a computer software company called Futique, which is the opposite of antique, you may have guessed. Does the counterculture live? How so? Let me introduce to you Timothy Leary.
Thank you. I was happy to be back in Bay Area. As we learned this morning, I spent many a year in this area, considered home. Well, we're looking back and forward today. I must say a lot of things have changed. A lot of things have changed. But one thing hasn't changed, and that is my basic bumper sticker, my basic t-shirt, my basic compass reading. It remains the same. It can be summarized in the five wonderful American red, white, and blue words, T-F-Y-Q-A. Think for yourself and question authority. And it is my my pleasure and my obligation today to try to give you, to encourage you and possibly help empower you to think for yourself, because thinking for yourself is not only the greatest thrill that can come to a member of our species, Homo sapiens sapiens, but it's also kind of risky. As you well know, there are many institutions that go back thousands of years and are apparently stronger today than ever that are totally dedicated to the proposition that human beings, individuals, are not supposed to think for themselves. Now, I wanted to raise a basic question. Came up in my mind, and I bet it came up in your mind too. I'm not being cosmic when I say, why are we here today? Now, the more cynical will say, think of all the C reasons. That we're here for cash. Well, that's not really true, because I want you to know that all the speakers that came here are, most of them, perhaps all of them, are getting half, maybe a third, maybe a fifth of what they would ordinarily command if they talked to the public out the rest of the country. So there's something special about San Francisco that brought Dr. Benjamin Spock up from St. Thomas and the rest of us from around the world. I think one of the reasons for me, and maybe for many of you, is just plain good old-fashioned curiosity to see how we've all changed in the last few years. I debated Abby Hoffman twice in the last 2 weeks, once with Hunter Thompson. That's a thrill and a half. Hunter hasn't changed. We debated Eldridge Cleaver in Toronto. Eldridge is saying, it's got to be militant, you got to be tough, you got to have everyone in uniform, you got to fight the enemy's got to like this and that. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. He was saying the same thing today he was saying 15 years ago, except then it was the good guys were Marxist-Leninism and the bad guys were the Republicans. And now Eldridge is a Republican Christian, but still the same old message, so he hasn't changed. Of course, Abby hasn't changed. Thank God. The more I see of Abby, I've seen him often in the last 20 years. I'm just grateful to have been around at a time when he's been around. He's been an unfailing beacon, source of energy and wit and sharp crusading zeal. Now, I disagree with Abby about 1% of the time. 99% of the time are... got the same enemies out there. As far as solutions are concerned, naturally his solutions are different from mine, but it's always a great pleasure to be around Abby. I think I should mention something about Harry Edwards. As you probably know, there was some sort of misunderstanding yesterday, and Mr. Edwards did not speak at this group. I don't pretend to know anything about the rights and wrongs of the situation, but I do want to honor what Harry Edwards has done in the past, that time 1968 in Mexico City, when it was Tommy Smith and those two young American individuals stood up there and told the world that they were unhappy with what's going on. That goes down in history in my book as one of the great examples of individual, peaceful, dramatic, cybernetic signal sending. And, you know, of all places, the Olympic Games, folks. Oh, geez. They're supposed to be carnivals and celebrations of nationalism, huh? And to have individuals get up and express their opinion. Oh, my God, we got to stop that sort of stuff. I don't know what the issue was yesterday. I feel that many changes taking place in America in the last 20 years... But certainly, our record on race relations is abysmal and deplorable and disgraceful. And I think that if in any way his action yesterday would remind us that, boy, we haven't even begun. And that issue, I thank him for that. Now, the title of my talk, at least as I have it in my mind, is as follows. Got it? Get ready. I'm going to be talking about the cyber society, : the popularization and personalization of high knowledge technology in the roaring 20th century. Okay? I'll run it through one more time. I start with roaring 20th century. Well, listen, folks, I'm 66 years old. I've been around 7 decades. So for me, all this talk about the 60s decade and the 50s and the 80s, come on, that's kiddie stuff. I mean, let's back up a little and get the perspective of centuries. You know, then you get to see that these decades are little waves, they're little ripples, and something that the pattern emerges maybe over 8 or 9 or 10 or 12 of these decades, particularly fast-moving decades like the ones we've been through in the roaring 20th century. So from this panoramic viewpoint, I can tell you that the 20th century was roaring. It's taken us in 7 or 8 brief decades from a civilization of robot assembly worker, Newtonian factory people into what's the beginning of, you know, the new thing you call the information age, communication age, the golden age of psychology, the age of individual cyberpunk, cybernaut, millions of names, and we don't even have the right names yet, but we all know that's happening, and it's been my pleasure in the last 66 years to have surfed almost every one of these wonderful decade waves. Now, it all began, in my viewpoint, very conveniently around the turn of the century. We know that typically the real changes in human nature, the changes in human politics and economics and society are brought about by two things, by people who have a map or a vision or a model of where we're going to go. These are the philosophers, and then the technicians, the people that get together the printing presses or the compasses or the high technology that can take us where we want to go. At the turn of the century, we had some magnificent philosophic navigators peering into the future. Einstein, of course, and again, Einstein probably didn't say this, but it's what we think Einstein said, and what a lot of people are afraid Einstein said when he talked about relativity, that in order to understand yourself, you have to understand the other point of view, the other perspective, and that my velocity and location can be determined only in terms of someone else. I mean, that is heavy-duty stuff, and all the monotheisms and the fundamentalist religions, philosophy, couldn't handle that. You know that in 1930, when Einstein came to America, he was considered as far out as a crack dealer. Really, the bishops and priests would say relativity. They sensed that Einstein had somehow let loose all the solidities and the stabilities. The idea of relativity. They knew, as Jerry Falwell knows today, that cultural relativity or ethical relativity, you're determining the right and wrongness of the situation depends upon the other situation. Hey, that's something that the boys cannot let happen. So Einstein deserves a great deal of credit for stirring things up. But that was nothing. Max Planck and the quantum physicists said, sorry, Newton, all these theories about a heavy-duty material world of force and momentum and energy and work and all those Bank of London heavy-duty conservative energy concepts, that works in the narrow, narrow range. But listen, Isaac, the basic elements of reality from galaxies to quarks are clusters and probability waves of off-on things called quanta or bits or bytes or yin-yang. In other words, now was that scary? Talk about a bad acid trip. The poor Farmer Brown or the poor guy in the turn of the century and his wife are trying to get together and deal with solid word, and suddenly Einstein says, all relative, and the quantum physicist says, hey, every place you put your fingers, it's, that's unsettling. And then Heisenberg came along and did the most incredible thing. He said, you never know anything about what's going out there except as you determine it by your technology, by your instruments, and by your thoughts and by your perception. So, in other words, it's a very... Heisenberg taught us to take the universe very personally, in both senses of the word. Now, if that's true, that if my reality is determined by my technology, it's a drop of blood, and I eyeball it, and you look at it through the microscope, and you look at an electron microscope, we've got three different versions of reality. Hey, oh, poor Farmer Brown, he's got a headache. How could he possibly become comfortable and happy and enjoy life in a world made up of changing relative parts of clusters of on-off things and where you make up your own mind about it? Hey. Well, the physicists were no help at all. Those guys are running around with the technology and knowledge technology that was Paleolithic. They were on the cave walls. They were using chalk. Amazing. Isn't that amazing? Suppose Einstein had Pac-Man. Or Niels Bohr had, one of these centipede games where you're moving things around the screen. Anyway, they didn't. So the man or woman in the street, heard these guys make these, formula, made no sense. So who's going to prepare a civilization of factory workers and farmers and people that haven't even got the Model T Ford yet? Who's going to prepare them for an Einsteinian, relativistic, quantum, physical, ever-changing, probabilistic universe? Who... Well, you know who you can count on. At every time in human history when we had to make a big philosophic lurch forward, who always came to the front and saved the day and showed us and made us feel happy and comfortable with a new future? I'm talking about those friends of ours that have always been around when we needed them. The musicians and the artists and the poets and the writers and the bards and the performers and the storytellers and, the minstrels, the rock and rollers, right? The actors are the scriptwriters, sure. The whole 20th century, to me, is the story of how artists and writers prepared us to be comfortable in a quantum physical world. For example, just the turn of the century, the artists took Newtonian reality and they totally demolished it. The expressionists, the impressionists, just panes of light coming out, hitting your eyeball. That's television, really. And then the pointillist, Seurat was literally painting in dots of like your Amiga computer, pixels. Surrealists, the Dada people, 20, 30, 40 years, all these artists were telling Farmer Brown, hey, it's not what you see there, it's not what you touch, but gradually then the commercial people took it over, and the advertising people produced it. Pretty soon, we're all fairly comfortable living in a Salvador Dali world where watches go over the end, and cubism where it's all, big step forward. We owe a great, great debt to certain audio physicists who came up from Mississippi. They were of Afro-American descent and taught us how to demolish the old musical standards. I'm talking about the black jazz musicians that really blew the old 19th century music. In the 19th century, it was all factory music. You had Beethoven, you had 17 violins, and you had 9 cellos over here, and occasionally a soloist could do the prescribed, individual stuff. But the jazz musicians got out there and they taught us improvisation and syncopation and innovation. And you never heard the same thing. And not only was I encouraged to innovate and improvise, but you were going to be listening to me and not lay off back, and then you take over and improvise. So pretty soon, instead of just one of us improvising, there are 3, 4, 5, 8 of us improvising. Now we're talking Marshall McLuhan talk when we do that. Then the writers. Tell you about James Joyce and most of the poetry of the 20th century is, again, breaking the word line, breaking the grammatical line. Radio was a great help. Radio was fabulous by 1920s and 30s when Farmer Brown and his wife could turn the dial of that little box and suddenly mystical, magical waves come in and they could hear Amos and Andy. That was very comforting. Or Lowell Thomas every evening. Or, believe it or not, Farmer Brown could watch the King of England, he'd listen to the King of England renouncing his throne for the woman he loved, or they could hear Hitler at Nuremberg. That's really made it live. Or they could hear Franklin Delano Roosevelt declaring World War II, was it? Yeah. That was not the Sony War, was it? No, that was the Pearl Harbor War. I'm going to keep it straight here. Right. Then, of course, screens. The old black and white films. That was amazing, it was amazing. Once you got going, you wouldn't predict it, but Farmer Brown and Mrs. Brown actually accepted the reality of Jerry Little figures on a screen. Indeed, those realities of Clara Bow and Clark Gable were more real than the people that they lived with. Interesting sign. The culture is getting softened up to see things in a screen, quantum, physical, electronic way. Well, World War II brought a sonar, radar, television. The baby boomers, by the time they were 3 or 4 years old, every day, with their little chubby hands turning the boob tube, every day, they experienced more data, more bits and bytes, more information, more panoramas, more geography, more history, more hype, more bullshit, you name it. In one day, they experienced more. They took in more data than the greatest Marco Polos in history before. So we're dealing here with a new culture and civilization, a new species, I don't know. We're talking about a generation of people who, since the time they were born, have been inundated by data, electronic data. To the baby boomers and the subsequent generations, electronic data is the ocean they swim in. It's the mother's milk they sucked in. It's the stuff they peep in pooh-pooed in their little plastic diapers. Data, data, data. They popped it, snorted it, snuffed it. They've been... Talk about a new generation. Now, the baby boomers, of course, are interesting for many reasons. They dominated the last half of the 20th century. And I found it a great pleasure to be in this room yesterday and down at a bar in San Francisco later on yesterday afternoon where I could really talk to Dr. Benjamin Spock. I consider him to be one of the most influential philosophers of all time. Now, he may not agree with that. You know, it's an interesting thing that sometimes people express things they're not aware of. Maybe, I don't know, I don't realize how important. He's such a modest man. What he did was give us the Bible of the 21st century, the information age. You had to have Dr. Spock telling parents. See, that's the thing. He's not talking to high school kids. He's talking to parents. And that Bible was a common sense book of child and baby care. And he told parents, I was one of them after World War II. We all walked around with this book. He'll deny it. He'll say he didn't say that in any, but I don't care what he actually said, what we thought he said. What's much more important, treat your kids as individuals. Treat your kids as individuals, yeah. The cliche is demand feeding. You don't feed them when in a factory civilization, there can't be demand feeding. You can't treat people individuals. You got a line up there and you got to put that screw in every time the hubcap comes along. You can say, hey, Cheech, I'm going to eat. Get back there, Chong. You can't eat. What kind of eat, man? We have to eat at 12 when the bell rings. Well, I'm hungry now. Well, you can't. You got to eat when the bell rings in a factory civilization. But here comes Dr. Spock telling, hey, feed them when they're hungry. Basically, of course, everybody got down on the poor doctor. He was blamed for the excesses of the 60s. I was glad to have him get blamed, otherwise I would have gotten blamed. But, what's the opposite of that? They did. What happened yesterday? They shut it down? Oh, you're the dread. Oh, you're the dread couple from Houston. Oh, my God. Let's make a deal, all right? You'll get 3 minutes, huh? Okay. Later on, you get 3 minutes, okay? 1.5 each, okay? All right, okay. Think about that. Well, you're waking up, huh? I'm a little sleepy myself. Sunday morning deals are kind of hard, aren't they? Anyone else got a comment or anything? Okay, we're talking about Benjamin Spock and this whole thing he did. Basically, you know, you could say that he started the consumer society. Now, I know that left-wing people and a lot of New Age people think it's terrible about the materialistic consumer society, but, you know, basically it's letting the individual decide what she or he wants and giving them a fair shot at getting it. I'm a great, great supporter of the consumer society. And by the way, I think Andy Warhol was an incredibly important American. How much do you know about Andy Warhol, huh? I'm not a great admirer of Rolling Stone magazine. But the current issue of Rolling Stone magazine has a wonderful article about Andy Warhol. It really lays down some of the stuff that Andy was saying. See, Andy was your first television kid. Andy, you know, said, gee, he said, life is like a television show. Talk about soap operas. Come on over to my place. And Andy, you know, could never get terribly involved because he was tape recording everything. And the badder it got, the crazier it got around him, the better show he had taped. I mean, that's a powerful, powerful concept of human, you know, lubrication, you know, when you think about it. Andy was suggesting that anybody, you can do it, you can get a $30 tape recorder and a $40 Polaroid, and you're in Andy Warhol's business. You can record everything that happens to you, and all the people that give you a bad time or a good time, you got all the, you know, the concept that you're the director and producer and photographer of your own life film. You know, but Andy would never say that, because all Andy ever said was, great. Great. Anyway, Dr. Spock, you know, in a sense, symbolizes the notion, you know, hey, Pepsi Generation, Wheaties, Breakfast Champion, you're the top, go all the way, you're entitled, you're American, hey, don't settle for anything, go out there. That's heavy-duty stuff to tell the children of a factory civilization, that they can go and get the best. But anyway, that's what we thought he said. Now, the whole thing was fine when we, your parents, were building primary schools, and were building high schools and colleges, and selling the kids hula hoops and all that. But the psychedelic pudding hit the fan in the 60s when the Spock kids hit high school and college. And they wanted a gourmet education, and they wanted connoisseur sex, and they wanted a connoisseur selective war or not war at Vietnam, and they wanted, you know, they wanted gourmet drugs. I mean, gee, we said you're the best, but we didn't realize that you guys would take us seriously. You'd actually want it. So, you know, I don't think Benjamin Spock understood that. I didn't understand it. And I don't put him down when I say he didn't understand what would happen when children who've been treated as individuals suddenly hit adolescence and sexual blossoming and all that. Okay, I've been talking to you about knowledge technology. Remember, I talked about art, and I talked about poetry, and I talked about jazz, and I talked about movies, and then I talked a little about computers, and then, of course, not about computers, but about television. In 1976, though, a real wave happened, and it was born not in a manger in Bethlehem, but in a garage in Silicon Valley, where St. Stephen the First and St. Stephen the Second brought us the personal thought appliance, the home computer. And they called it Apple after the first member of our species, Homo sapiens, the first person to think for herself, of course, Eve in the Garden of Eden, who ate the unauthorized fruit. I've been involved in computer, the computer adventure, the computer experience. For about 4 years now, and I was brought into it by a man named Buddy Diamond. Buddy, where's Buddy? Buddy is from St. Paul, and he did the NFL Challenge. Anyway, Buddy picked me off of a plane and going from St. Paul to New York and said, you're going to have a career, boy, and software. He's a strong-minded man, and here I am. I've been involved in software for about 4 years now, and we're all very disappointed. We're all very disappointed in ourselves and the culture. Why? Because we know these personal computers, now the Amigas and the enhanced color and graphics, can put on your screen stuff better than you've seen it on the big movie screen. You can literally be the director, producer of your own films. I mean, there's simply no end to the thought classification and thought processing and changing. And yet it hasn't happened. Why? Why? Why don't we have... my wife Barbara is a very intelligent person, a very sophisticated person, and I have a 13-year-old boy who's very intelligent and sophisticated. Neither one of them would look at a piece of software. They went through Pac-Man. They went through it 5 years ago, but they're going to play Pac-Man for the rest of their life. There is simply no software for intelligent, college-educated, book-reading, movie-reading, people who like to be intellectually stimulated. I mean, sure, there are word processing and there's accounting sheets, but, I mean, what is there that would really take the place of a great book? Well, when we tear our hair and say, geez, how have we failed, you realize that this whole profession is only 11 years old. See, Wozniak and Jobs they didn't invent it, but they put it together and merchandised it in 1976. So we're only an 11-year-old kid. Now, I believe in recapitulation. I believe ontogeny repeats phylogeny. I think cosmology repeats biology. I think electronics recapitulates everything. We're only 11 years old. See, first we had Pong, that was little baby stuff. And then we got Pac-Man, that's kind of baby stuff. And then we got, Donkey Kong, we're learning how to walk around. Then we got Donkey Kong Jr., we could swing like a primate, that's getting up there. When Activision, Infocom, came out with a game called The Leather Goddesses of Phobos last year, leaving aside the sexist implications, or the kinky sex implications, but the very thought that the software public was getting interested in things like boys and girls, it's a good sign in the wind. So maybe we'll have some... I'm proud to say that I have done a shakedown cruise of the software industry, and I have located a few intelligent, sophisticated people in software. And one of them is in the audience tonight, Stuart Bond from Electronic Arts. Where's Stuart? Hey, there he is right there. He's produced my product, Mind Mirror, Electronic Arts, and he's one of the rare and special people in the field. Tim Mott of Electronic Arts and Brenda Laurel of Activision. By the way, I'm working on a software program which I think is very relevant to a discussion about the 60s and the future. It's a program based upon a book called Neuromancer. How many of you heard of the book Neuromancer by William Gibson? You got to think about this. William Gibson, Neuromancer. It has started a new genre of literature called cyberpunk, if you're ready for that. Neuromancer is a book, it's a science fiction book. It won all three awards, the Hugo, the Nebula, and the prestigious Philip Dick Award. But it's not science fiction, it's more science faction. It's the way the world's going to be in 10 years from now, like it or not. You can even see it around the corner if you know where to look. A very interesting world, which I'd like to tell you a little about, and very comforting, because it's a world that's post-political, post-partisan politics, post-religion. It's an interesting world that Gibson lays out in this book. So we're doing a software program called Neuromancer. Now, the key concept here is cyberpunk. You're going to hear a lot about cyberpunk. I've got an article in Spin Magazine this week about cyberpunk. The word cyber is a wonderful word. It's my key to the roaring 20th century. Cyber. Now, I hate the word cybernetics. Cybernetics was developed by Norbert Wiener in 1948, and he said cybernetics is the science of control and feedback of biological human processes or biomechanical. Control, control, control. But you look up the word cyber, and the word cyber comes from the Greek word pilot. Wiener made it governor or made it steersman, pilot. You see, the Greeks were sailors, and they were out there sending their little craft around the Mediterranean, and they couldn't get any radioed instructions from headquarters. There was no manual or book or Bible to tell them what to do. They had to weave their way through the islands, and they had to check the... they didn't have any navigational stuff, poor maps, and get their way back. They had to think for themselves. T-F-Y-Q-A, you sure had to do that if you were a Greek pilot. And it's no accident, perhaps, and once those pilots got back on land, they developed the great, great moments of human philosophy, where everyone was running around thinking for him or herself. The philosophies in Athens were thrilling. Everybody thought they had the right to work out their own philosophy. Cyber is very interesting. See, the word steersman comes from the Latin word stare, which means to stand, or it means the stuff you stand on. That leads to status, state, prostitution, constitution, institution. Get it? The Roman word, the Romans were not out there individuals piling their boats. The Romans were in galleys, right? The Romans were building aqueducts, building enormous roads which they're marching all their reliefs. So to them, a steersman is someone who's steering the legions down that. Very different from the word pilot. So if cyber means pilot, see, that ties into Heisenberg, because Heisenberg is basically saying, everyone, physicist or not, you're kind of crafting, you're navigating your own way through reality. And the word cyber suggests that have a model that if enough people become pilots of their lives, we could have what's called a cyber society. Now remember that was the title of my talk, The Cyber Society. I made you forget, didn't I? Okay. We made it. Okay. Thought I was rambling, didn't you? The cyber society. is a society obviously made up of individuals. Individuals who think for themselves, linked up with other individuals who think for themselves. So, now what does this mean? According to, in Gibson's world, of course, it's all knowledge. People don't work in the near future, except in countries where they want to work, because it's insulting, humiliating for any human being to be forced economically to perform a behavior that can be done better by a robot or computer. So, oh my God, if we don't work, what about the Protestant ethic? What about the workers' paradise, the Soviet Union? Yeah, what happened to that? If we're not going to work, what are we going to do? Because after all, the aim of life is to work. Freud said it. And my daddy told me that too. Work is the key. Work. If we don't work, what are we going to do? Well, number one, you're going to pilot, navigate. Number two, you're going to perform. Number three, you're going to, you're going to work in an information center. Interestingly enough, you know, there's a lot more fun and a lot more challenge, a lot more to do if you're not a worker. Because if you're a worker, you're just doing what you're told. But if you're out there navigating, piloting, charting, figuring out, maneuvering through this new world of information, there's a lot to do. Another thing about the cyber society that Gibson and his friends portray is a tremendous individual choice. There's no more complaining about the government or about what happened to persecution. In an age of affordable beauty, you can be as beautiful as you want. Now, we know that a lot of people that become pretty fanatic and angry about life are people that don't think they're good-looking. You know, I mean, think about it. If you look in the mirror and you don't like what you see there, you're going to be a pain in the ass for the rest of the day, if you ask me. Now, you see, this is a heavy concept. Remember, the Catholic Church wants everybody dressed the same. And under Maoism, everyone wore the same wonderful psychedelic black robe. And it was heavy duty when, you can wear a little color. No shit, color. Well, you can raise the skirts a little, or you can change it. I mean, I can wear anything I want to wear? Hey, that's pretty revolutionary, isn't it? Well, if you can do that, then maybe I can have my hair the way I want it to. Yeah, maybe I can put on makeup or not. Even men? No, not men. Oh, yeah, sure. If I can change the way I look and I dress and all that, and then I can cosmetics, then get surgery. Facial surgery? Yeah, why not? Then you get into muscle implants. What do you want to play for the Lakers? Okay, baby. Well, you want two more feet? Hey, boy, give this girl two more feet. And you can literally, there's no excuse anymore. You can literally be the person you want to be. Of course, that's the looks is the least important. It's the mind and the ability to maneuver and manage your mind. Then the word cyber. Cyber is no longer C-Y, it's P-S-Y. Get it? Yeah. Because in the future, everyone's got to be a psychologist. You simply got to be a psychologist. You're not a psychologist, you're not able to keep up with what's going on. Really? Oh, yeah. Racial problems. Presumably, they'll be diminished in a world where you can be any color you want for as long as you want to. Go for it. Make a statement. politics. Politics is kind of interesting. Nationalism is finished. The people who run the world, talking about the Swiss and the Japanese, of course, simply don't want to have Russia and America bombing each other because Japan owns America. And don't want to destroy all that real estate. So nationalism is pretty beyond the pale in the next 20, 30 years. There are no police very much because, you see, in a society where scarcities are all artificial. We know that. Even when there's less scarcity, you don't need police that way. The police, the main police, are the brain police, the mind police, the scientific police. The big multinational combines that control most of the world they want to control. They have their own police forces that kidnap scientists and, or kidnapping techniques and so forth. And there's a tremendous police force to protect your data. So you're not protecting territory anymore. You're protecting structures and the edifices of data data, cyberspace data is the new continents that we have to explore. Anyway, I won't get too far into that. But the The people that run things, it's a very pragmatic society, information society, like Andy Warhol. See, Andy Warhol doesn't really care that much about what you do. He's not going to try to order you around. The people that run things don't care about drugs or sex or anything like that. See, as long as you got to consume. And there's an enormous, enormous underground in Gibson's world. I mean, there's enormous jungles where the people are selling hot DNA chips and black market brain implants from Tokyo. And the people that run things like that. Because, see, most of these moralities and crusades come from, you know, feudal people that that can't handle the notion of the information society. Well, what else? Theology. There's a tremendously, tremendously fascinating theology in Gibson's stuff about next level. The next level of higher intelligence, or God, or I don't care what you want to call her. The feudal God is a shepherd God. You know, the Lord is my shepherd. He makes me lie down. And the Pope of Rome is the big shepherd. And he takes care of his flock. I mean, can you believe that? They're still saying that today. And in the industrial age, of course, God is the Newtonian engineer that runs everything and so forth. But the higher intelligence in an information age, psychological age, is, of course, like pure intelligence. It's a very dignified, kind of amusing concept of higher intelligence that that Gibson portrays. Well, now, wait a minute. What else can I possibly do in an hour? I've taken you through the wrong 20th century. I've explained physics, art, jazz. I've explained, what have I left? Politics, religion, sex? What have I left? The 60s? Oh, the 60s were the adolescence of the baby boom. Each decade of the last half of the 20th century just marks a stage, a phase, a metamorphic interlude in the, in the baby boomers. Okay. How many of you in this room are between the ages of 25 and 40? Huh?
See the power? I'm talking power. Friends, that's power.
76 million baby boomers. You totally monopolized American industry when you were in the Eisenhower days. Every time you whimpered, the industry gave you what you wanted. But you've never had any power politically. It's true that you elected a hippie president in 1976, Jimmy Carter. Howdy doody. That was pretty hot. Jimmy Carter with a sleeping bag and Bob Dylan records and lust in his heart, boy. Talking about peace and love. Human rights. Hey, give me a break, Jimmy. Smoke another joint. Peace and love. Hey, you invited the Egyptian and the Zionist guy over there? That give peace a chance, Menachem? All you need is love, Sadat, huh? Yeah. You got rid of him. Anyway, see, the 60s, I'm glad you brought the 60s. The 60s started in the year 67. You remember that. Nothing much was happening in the year 64, believe me. The 60s started in 67. They peaked in 76 with Carter. Gotta say that. And the 60s came to a lurching, thudding stop in the year 1980 when we elected Nancy Reagan.
And yes, I'm afraid that that is exactly where this tape cut off. But in a way, the strange ending to Dr. Leary's talk has given me the sign that I should add one more short soundbite to this podcast. But first, I'd like to say a few things about the talk we just heard. There is a lot I'd like to say about it, but I'll try to keep it to a few generalities. For one thing, I thought it was very touching of Dr. Leary to give Andy Warhol such a nice tribute. And if the dates in Wikipedia are correct, Andy had just died 1 month before this talk. So when you recall what Timothy said just a few minutes ago about artists being the ones we can always count on to pull humanity through its dark hours, well, it was a nice touch to have Andy Warhol mentioned and memorialized at the same time. Also, he mentioned his dream of the end of the Protestant work ethic. And if that topic is of interest to you, then I highly recommend a little book by Pekka Himanen titled The Hacker Ethic. And even if you aren't into high tech and what you may think of as hackers, I think you'll be surprised at the amazing philosophy contained in that little volume. Now, if you don't come away with anything else after listening to one of Timothy Leary's talks, I hope you come away with his mantra, think for yourself and question authority. Now, the example I'm about to use may seem really trivial at first blush, but my point in mentioning it is that even in the tiny little details of life, it can be interesting to think for yourself. And what I'm thinking about is a T-shirt that I saw a person wearing in the gym recently. I couldn't make out the name of the company on the front, but on the back it read, Live Generously. Now that's a nice thought, I thought at first. And then I noticed the little TM next to the phrase. Yep, those generously living people who made that shirt also trademarked the phrase, Live Generously. Which means that for saying it several times just now, I suppose I owe them some money. So I thought for myself and figured out that those people probably weren't very generous themselves. They just want us to be generous so they can charge us for the idea. I know it's a trivial example, but if you don't think for yourself about these little things that assault our senses 1,000 times a day, we will continue to be swept along in this mad commercial sea of advertising and consumption. You know, think for yourself about what things you really need and question all authority. All authority, particularly any authority types you might come across here in the salon, I might add. Think for yourself and question authority. And since I'm already off track, I also want to bring up Hunter S. Thompson, who Dr. Leary briefly referred to in the talk we just heard. While I'm sure that most of our fellow saloners are very familiar with Hunter Thompson's work, there may be a few who haven't read him yet. So I want to give you my recommendation on a book of Thompson's that you might like. And that is his collection of short stories titled The Great White Shark Hunt. I won't go on because I could talk about Thompson for a long time. But if you're in the mood for some good laughs, well, just stop by your local library or bookstore and check out a copy. I'm sure the ghost of old Hunter will see that you are well entertained. Now, one of the reasons I'm playing this particular talk of Dr. Leary's today is that I'd like you to think about how excited he was with the state of technology at that particular moment in time. And then think about how much things have changed during the course of the 21 years since he gave this talk. If you get a chance, you might want to go back and reread Gibson's Neuromancer trilogy. I did just that not too long ago and discovered that we may now be closer to the mad world of Gibson's fiction than we are to the Ozzie and Harriet fantasy of the 50s. And here is one more example, maybe a little strained on my part. But after listening to the short 12-minute soundbite I'm about to play for you, well, I don't know how to describe it, really. Maybe it's just me and my connection to the news that was always playing in the background during those years that draws me to listen to this little clip again. But I guess you'll just have to be the judge of this for yourself. In the introduction to today's talk, we heard Abby Hoffman mention Eldridge Cleaver. And then we heard Timothy Leary mention Cleaver as well. And since most of our fellow saloners already know this history, I'll try to be really brief. And this comes mainly from Wikipedia. Leary went to prison in January of 1970, and in September 1970, he escaped. Leary claimed his nonviolent escape was a humorous prank and left a challenging note for the authorities to find after he was gone. For a fee paid by the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, the weathermen smuggled Leary and his wife Rosemary Woodruff Leary out of the United States and into Algeria, where he sought the patronage of Eldridge Cleaver and the remnants of the separatist USA Black Panther Party's government in exile. And after staying with them for a short time, Leary claimed that Cleaver had attempted to hold he and his wife captive, or hostage. But in 1971, Leary fled, or he escaped, or whatever, from Cleaver's control and was on the run for a while before eventually returning to prison. Now, on some levels, Tim Leary's life is really an amazing adventure story. And my recommendation for the first place to begin learning about it is from Dr. Leary's own autobiography, which he titled Flashbacks. And it's really a great read if you haven't done so yet. But what I want to do now is to play a tape for you that I found in the Timothy Leary archive. And for some reason I can't quite identify, it has struck a strange chord in me. As I just mentioned, there was a time in Tim Leary's life when he didn't think so highly of Eldridge Cleaver. Even as late as 1987, when the talk we just heard was given, I don't think he sounded that close to Eldridge. Now, flash forward about 8 years to January 7th, 1995. And what you are about to hear is a private message that Eldridge Cleaver sent to a person he obviously considers a dear friend, Tim Leary. Now, this message is only about 12 minutes long, and in it, Eldridge Cleaver, the fiery former information minister for the Black Panther Party, is attempting to enlist Leary in his plan to help get a woman elected president in the year 2000. And as you listen to this very intimate message, just think about the fact that this very prominent and proud man of color believed a woman would be able to make it to the White House before a black man would. A little over 3 years after this recording was made, both Tim and Eldridge had died. So one can only wonder about what they would think about the election campaign now taking place here in the States. But right now, here is what Eldridge Cleaver was thinking on January 7th, 1995.
Good morning, Timothy. This is Eldridge Cleaver. I'm sending you a message to go along with the letter that accompanied this tape. I'm doing this in a public place, so there's a lot of background noise. I'm at the ex-caravansary, which they now call the Roma Espresso Roma Cafe. It's on the corner of Ashby and College in Berkeley. This is my favorite spot that I come to. Timothy, I was so happy to see you and talk to you and be back in touch with you. And I have a project which I beg you to participate in with me. I was thinking of this when I said to you that we can now crown our careers, you know. The struggle that we have both been involved in for many years definitely was aimed at creating a better world. And we're at a juncture now, both of you, you and myself, we are at a point in our lives now where we don't have a lot of more time, a lot of more things to do, but as a result of the way that this country has been going politically, I believe that we are faced with a very major crisis. And I believe that you and I are well situated. We have been prepared to really do something very powerful and very useful for our country and for the world. I've spelled it out in some detail in the letter, but it has to do with the aspiration and the dream of America for the equality and the fulfillment of our national destiny. And I believe that you and I can launch a movement that will result in the election of a woman to the presidency of the United States in the year 2000, the election of the year 2000. With Bill Clinton stumbling around with his dick hanging out of his pocket, fucking up at every turn, weak, he is dissipating all of the influence and power on the Democratic Party and to the left of that. And we now have looming on the horizon this jerk Newt Gingrich and all that he represents and all the garbage. I'm sure that over the next couple of years, till we get to 1996, which is the next presidential election year, we're going to see this country being provoked and stirred up in a very unwholesome manner, with the very strong possibility that we might end up either in 96 or in the year 2000 with that jerk Newt Gingrich running for president or becoming president. I don't think he'll be able to do it in 1996, but I'm sure he's looking at that, and he's also looking to 2000. Well, I believe that we can preempt the field by taking the action that I have spelled out in this paper. I don't want you to misunderstand me. I am not talking about you and I having any kind of organizational responsibility. That's why I said we would godfather the project. That is, we would launch it and put it out there. And then the women and the type of women that I mentioned on the list that I gave there, these are the people that we can call together. And I ask you to add some names to the list or delete some. But we need a core group of women that we can meet with and nail down this project with and get them going on it and send out the call to America that we elect a woman president of the United States in the year 2000 to save this country from this old boy network, which I have described very good, I believe, in the document. And I am asking you to join with me in doing this. I will come down to L.A., and then we would have the press release to make out, and then the pink paper, the position paper to draw up. And the rest of it, you and I are quite capable of handling it at the press conference. We just have to know, announce this purpose, call the country to this emergency, and send out, we will publicly state the invitation to these women, but we will also send them a special invitation by mail. And then we have to decide on all these dates. I don't know if there's enough time to do this before the President's State of the Union message. I'm quite willing to do it after. We would have to give it at least two weeks after he makes that speech, because they're going to be chopping that up for eons. And we might have to do it in February. But I would like to get it going as soon as we possibly can. I'll come down to L.A. and huddle with you for a few days. And then we'll call together some aides. We got a group of aides who will help us at the press conference. And we'll have to think about how we do that and where we do it. I'd like to see it done in a first-class manner at some impressive location. It doesn't have to be the Hotel Bonaventure. Maybe you have a better idea, and I'll be willing to do it wherever you say. And let's please get this thing in motion, because I think that when you look at all the problems that confront the United States, the main problem is the bad relationship between men and women, and it really goes back to the Inquisition, when the women were subjected to a Holocaust by the Catholic Church, by lawyers and by doctors who were jealous of their power. The doctors and the lawyers framed up the evidence to support the charge of witchcraft, and then the Catholic Church put them on trial in the Inquisition tribunals, and they publicly executed over 100,000 women. They confiscated their property and sullied their name. These women were high priestesses of the goddess religion that goes back before recorded time. And these people were respected by the masses. They didn't trust these doctors. They didn't trust lawyers. And they were very pissed off at the Catholic Church because of all of the atrocious shit that the Catholic Church was doing. And the Dominican order were the ones who were like the court clerks in the Inquisition tribunals, and they recorded what took place and the words and all that stuff. And then after the tribunals were closed down in 1550, the Pope ordered the Jesuits to take control of all of the education to suppress all memory of this procedure. And when the Jesuits went out to destroy the records, the Dominican order wouldn't give them their files, because they didn't like the Jesuits for good reason. They didn't trust them. They knew about a lot of dirty shit that the Jesuits had been doing, and so they would not give them their records of the tribunal. And you may have heard of this theologian by the name of Matthew Fox, who's been censored and silenced by the Vatican a couple of times. He's a member of the Dominican Order. He's recently resigned because of all of the repression that's taking place in the church. And when you hear the Pope continually repeating that women cannot be ordained as ministers, it is because he fears what will happen if women are ever empowered again and to restore their respect and their stature, that there will be a vital threat to the male supremacy throne of the Pope. And, you know, men establish masculine supremacy over women, masculine superiority, I should say, through brute force. You see the image of the caveman dragging the woman by her hair into the cave, this kind of shit. But women didn't believe in that, and a lot of men didn't believe in that. But the Catholic Church took the initiative to establish a theology, an ideology of masculine supremacy, preaching God the Father and the male Messiah Jesus. And this totally obliterates the logical necessity that our Creator must be both male and female. Otherwise, he could not have done what I don't like to say he about God, because God is not a he or a she. God is an us. God is not some fucking human being running around here, an old man on the clouds with a beard. That's bullshit. And the world needs to be liberated from this. And I believe that when we take this step and deal with the gender healing by supporting these women, I think it'll go a long way to help breaking up this old boy network and put a woman's heart in our politics, so that we can stop fucking over the children, destroying the educational system, and playing these games that boys play with war toys and shit. We have an opportunity. We have a great challenge. The United States has a responsibility to straighten this fucking world up and nail it down and get this shit out of the way and get these punks out of the way and keep running around stirring up the water. We're inundated by bullshit right now, Timothy. And you and I don't have to try to control this organization. We only need to be members if the women invite us to be. I'm not talking about setting up an all-women's organization, but I think that the kind of women that I have named here, the movers and the shakers, need to be at the heart of it, at the core of it. And if they want us on the board of directors, they can invite us. We can talk to them. But I'm not worried about that. I want them to pull together a large central committee or board of directors, whatever they want to call it, that would be staffed with qualified people who can then draw up their own documents and so forth, their procedures, and begin the work now of establishing offices in every city of the United States and begin the process of propagandizing for the election of a woman in the year 2000. Which woman, I don't know, but there are a lot of qualified women out there, and we might take Newt Gingrich's vocabulary and call for the election of a bitch, because I think the woman he called a bitch is quite capable of doing the job. But we'll leave those details to the shaking out process. It's not for you and I to determine who this woman will be. What you and I can do, and it will be to our credit, it will be a great credit to the United States, because we both have a lot of influence and respect upon millions and millions of people in the United States. And we put out the initial call to take this action, and then we will be in a supporting role from then on. We will support these women. We can brainstorm. And I'm sure that you will have a billion ideas about how to put this out there and get it in circulation. And we have 5 years to make it work. We can do it, Timothy. Let's do it. Please consider what I am saying here. And then, after you read this stuff, let me know. Give me some dates when we can sit down and talk. And I'll come down there, and we'll get this shit straight. And we will change history, as we have done considerably already. But this time we will do a monumental task that no one is really talking about right now. And let's be the first ones to put this out there on the practical table, and let's make it happen. All right, Timothy. Hope you receive this. I'm going to put it in the mail right now, and really looking forward to you digesting this and responding. God bless you, brother. Love you. All right. Talk to you later.
Well, what can I say after that? Maybe you have to have lived through the days when Leary and Cleaver were in the news every night in order to get the full impact of this interesting message from the grave. Actually, I've been hesitating to play this little historical tidbit during the current U.S. election cycle because I most certainly don't want to do anything to give the impression that I am in any way supporting the current woman candidate for president. I most definitely do not support the idea of having yet another Bush or Clinton family member continue to control the White House as they have already done now for almost 30 years. As you know, I do my best to keep politics out of this podcast, and that will continue to be my goal. But I want to make it very clear that, yes, this old cynic, the guy who voted for Leonard Peltier in 2004, has actually been impressed by what Barack Obama is doing. Particularly among the most important and yet the least represented generations, those 35 years old and under. These are the people who are going to have to live with the consequences of continuing on the obviously irrational path that the U.S. has been on these past 7 years, thanks in no small measure to our own inbred version of Caligula going ever more insane right before our eyes. Do I agree with everything Obama says? Of course not, and I doubt if many of his supporters do either. But when I was in college, I heard Kennedy give his inaugural address, and on the radio, I also heard Dr. King's famous I Have a Dream speech. And I can still remember many of the emotions that swept through me on those rare occasions. Now, maybe I'm just morphing from a hardened cynic into a sentimental old man, but even if that's the case, I'm well, I'm sure it'll seem like an improvement to my closest associates. But I have to tell you, particularly our fellow saloners who don't live in the U.S., that there is something different about the spirit that this young, half-black, half-white politician is invoking in his audiences. While Mrs. Clinton struggles to get 800 people to attend her big rallies, Obama packs 18,000 and more into auditoriums and turns more away at the door. I have no idea of what this is all about or where it's leading. But I can tell you from my own experience that there's an energy coming alive today that I hope is going to make the 60s look boring. So, as I think the captain of the Enterprise said, words to the effect of, make it so. Okay, enough. Sorry about that, but it sure felt good to get it off my chest. So there you have it. Lorenzo the Cynic is voting for Obama, even if I have to write in his name on my ballot this November. And hopefully this will be my last political outburst, at least for a long time. Now let's close with some feedback from a few of our fellow saloners, and I'm trying to pick a couple of comments that represent the thoughts of several others as well. This is from Jeff M., who writes, I stumbled upon the Dopecast about 4 months ago, and luckily about 2 months ago I came across, while listening to KMO on one of the early episodes of Psychonautica, your psychedelic salon. At first I was completely overwhelmed with all of the new information that I had come into contact with, and I had no clue where to go first. I had no idea that such a community even existed. I must admit that living in a predominantly white middle-class area can be absolutely horrifying at times, not to mention pretty lonely. However, after realizing that I am by no means alone in my worldviews and appreciation of these beautiful medicines, my life has become a lot more tolerable and much more enjoyable. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for bringing up the fact that while the psychedelic community is huge on a worldwide basis, the problem is that a good many of us feel like we're the last sane person on the planet. And, in fact, this is the main reason I do these podcasts. You see, until January of 1999, I was living in almost the same circumstances as you are today. I had one friend my age who also used psychedelics and smoked a little grass, but we didn't have any contact with others of like mind, primarily, I guess, because of where we were living. And then I went to an entheobotany seminar in Palenque, Mexico, and within 6 months I'd quit my job and moved to Southern California, where I now find myself surrounded by like-minded people. But not everybody can do what I did. at the time, my youngest child had already finished college. I was living alone and had no strings attached. You know, it was the perfect time for me to make a radical change in my life. In fact, such opportunities hardly ever happen to most people. So I figured that the next best thing to relocating physically is that a bunch of us could relocate in cyberspace for an hour or so each week and recharge through what I fantasize as eventually a 24/7 group mind of some kind. And we may be approaching the time when, no matter when you are listening to one of these podcasts, there will be several other people listening to the Psychedelic Salon also. I have no way of monitoring the mirror sites and radio stations that are rebroadcasting these podcasts, but on our own two servers, I know that there's never a minute of the day that several people aren't downloading copies of the Salon. So the chances are that no matter when you are with us here in the Psychedelic Salon, that there are some of your fellow saloners here with you. Now, getting back to reality, here is what else Jeff had to say. Your fantastic energy and incredibly informative work has deeply inspired me beyond words. I'm so grateful that people like yourself have gone to the lengths that you have to provide all of this information for free. Alas, I'm a student and have little to no income whatsoever. But I'd like you to know that if you keep doing what you're doing into the following years, I will definitely be sending donations your way. I'm sure you get emails like this all of the time, but I really felt it just necessary to send something your way. Thanks for the kind words, Jeff, and I do admit to getting a lot of messages from students and people of all ages who have practically no disposable income and yet they feel bad about not being able to make a donation to the Salon. First of all, let me say that I've never had to ask for donations to meet our expenses because they just seem to always arrive at the right moment. It's really amazing that some weeks there won't be a donation and then several come in all at one time. And so I don't have any concerns about keeping these podcasts going, and you shouldn't worry about it either. Believe me, I know what it's like to be strapped for cash, and if you aren't careful, it can really wear you down. So I think I'm speaking for all of the people who have made financial donations to the Salon and saying that one of the reasons they've made these donations is to help get these podcasts out to people who couldn't afford to go to Mind States or to Burning Man or a conference or someplace like that. So this is also their way and my way of sharing some of the gifts that life has given us. Your turn is going to come, and the day will arrive when you too can pass it forward. Well, I hadn't planned for this program to go on so long, so I'll just read part of one more message I received recently. It's from our friend Dharma Built, who says, among other things, "Hi, Lorenzo. I'm glad that you're feeling better. And by the way, thank you to all of you who have also passed that thought along. And yes, I'm feeling great." Dharma Built goes on, "I've been listening to your latest, McKenna/Palomary, and thoroughly enjoy both. Notice that I didn't use the past tense, as I tend to listen to these a few times, always catching something on each play. It definitely helps the day go by as I plug away in a corporate environment. I'm a freelancer, though. I trade income security and health benefits for freedom. It's a struggle, but I haven't been able to find the right thing quite yet, so this is a reasonable solution." Well, as I just said a few minutes ago, I was 56 years old before I finally broke free of the corporate world, so let's hope that you won't have to wait so long. Dharma Built goes on, "I'm also trying to see my way clear to take a trip to Amazonian Peru for shamanic work with various sacred medicines. I've got some experience, but not in that context or with the specific plants that this area is known for. I know, and respect the reasoning, that you don't make a recommendation or give advice in this regard. But perhaps you could give me a general indication. I would love to go to Luis Eduardo Luna's, but it's a little too pricey for me. If you opt not to respond, I completely understand and respect your position." Yeah, this is really a tough situation. First of all, let me mention what I see as the light at the end of the tunnel. In my own case, it took me about 10 years of searching before making a connection with a practicing and reputable Iowa Scarrow. And for 9 years now, I've been a member of a small group who journeys together several times a year. And they are actually the light at the end of your search, your group, the one you finally end up feeling at home with and participating with on a regular basis. They will eventually materialize, I'm sure of that. Now, for what small amount of practical advice I can give you, besides a warning to beware of people who claim to be Iowa Scaros but who have few credentials to back up their claims. I found my group after years of interacting with people I met at various conferences. And as I said, I was lucky because I had a high-paying job and the leisure time to afford to go to those conferences. So what do you do if you're poor? You know, it's hard to say because poor is different for different people. But the one thing that I believe will give you the best chance of making the connections you're looking for is to somehow, some way, scrape up the money and time to attend one of Alan Shoemaker's shamanism conferences in Iquitos, Peru. And I'll try to remember to put up a link to those conferences along with the program notes to this podcast. And if you decide to go, it would be really cool of you to make your reservation through my friend and fellow podcaster, KMO, who gets a little commission from Alan for kind of watching out for our fellow saloners down there at the conference. You know, I think these conferences are in July, but for sure, this would be the first place I would go right now if I were you. Well, I guess that had better be it for today. And as always, I want to close by saying that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, you can click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at www.psychedelicsalon.org. And that's also where you're going to find the program notes for these podcasts. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.